Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-3053, United States of America versus Swanson O. Oroche, appellant. Mr. O'Shaughnessy for the appellant, Ms. Ali Khan for the appellee.
Morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'm Michael O'Shaughnessy on behalf of appellant Swanson Oroche. And Your Honors, the Kimbrough versus United States case holds that the district court must sentence a defendant to a sentence which is sufficient but not greater than necessary. And in this case, that has not happened. During the sentencing proceedings, the district court stated that, and I quote, "I can tell you right now that it is the court's intent to sentence Mr. Oroche to time served on all counts." And this was not just a passing comment made by the district court at that time. The district court had considered both parties' sentencing memoranda, had been privy to this case for a number of years, and had thought through many of these issues. And in light of the circumstances of the case, the facts, and all of the factors, the district court determined that time served, which was 84 months at that time, was the appropriate sentence for Mr. Oroche. Under the sentencing guidelines and in consideration of all of sentencing factors.
What happened after that?
At that time, Your Honor, the probation officer stood up and said, "Well, Your Honor, you know, there is this acquitted conduct, I understand, but really you should consider that acquitted conduct in making your sentencing determination." And the district court then said, "Well, I don't want to guess at this. Let's go ahead and brief it, and I'll consider that acquitted conduct and see where that sets us." And so then after some briefing, additional briefing and some argument, the district court then changed the sentence that he had indicated he was going to impose and raised the sentence from time served to the current sentence, which is almost double of what the sentence originally would have been. And the sentence was based on his consideration of acquitted conduct only. And one problem with that, Your Honors, is that it suggests that the district court was using, number one, was using acquitted conduct to increase the sentence over what was reasonable in violation of Kimbrough, which states that the sentence must be sufficient but not greater than necessary, and also in violation of Booker, which holds that the sentencing guidelines are to be viewed as advisory only and not mandatory.
I think he referred to the sentencing guidelines a few times as advisory, didn't he, in the colloquy?
He did, Your Honor, and it is true that the district court judge did.
He obviously knew they were not mandatory.
He did know that, and he did state that. However, his actions suggest a different result. While he did state that they were advisory, he applied them in a mandatory fashion. As he had stated before on the record,
What does that mean? He stated they were mandatory, but applied them in a. Stated they were advisory, but applied them in a mandatory fashion.
Well, I mean, it's one thing to say that they're advisory only, but it's another thing to apply them in an advisory fashion. If he believed that they were advisory, he should have applied. He should have imposed a sentence of time served, as he had already stated he felt was the appropriate and reasonable sentence. However,
that was not his final decision. That was something he said along the way. He did not enter a judgment at that point. He continued the case for further consideration. And
you're correct, Your Honor.
I don't see how that establishes he thought they were mandatory, that he gave a guideline, a consistent sentence after having said they were advisory, that was different than something he thought along the way. It may be error of some sort, but I don't see how you conclude that he thought they were mandatory.
Well, Your Honor, because he was at the time that he stated that he believed time served was the appropriate and reasonable sentence at the time, he was prepared to impose a sentence on that day. He was ready to impose a sentence. However, when he went back and he considered the acquitted conduct, he then changed his mind.
That just means he considered the acquitted conduct. It doesn't mean that he considered the guidelines to be mandatory.
Well, he had knowledge of the acquitted conduct prior to that time. He's had this case for since 2001. He was aware of that conduct. He had just granted the acquittal on that date. He was well aware of it. It was just that the probation officer had told him, well, Your Honor, actually, if you look at the guidelines require that he be sentenced to a minimum of 145 months. And so once the judge...
He found them to be advisory and helpful and came to a different conclusion. But that's not to say he thought they were mandatory.
Well,
You're saying that to consider them is to render them something other than advisory. And I don't see how you can reach that conclusion. You may have an argument here on improper use of acquitted conduct, but I don't see how you get from following the guidelines to thinking they're mandatory.
Well, Your Honor, I don't see any other way that a judge could apply sentencing guidelines in a mandatory fashion.
I don't know what that means, apply in a mandatory fashion. If you think they're advisory and you think they make sense and you follow them, that's not the same thing as thinking they're mandatory. I don't understand what you mean by apply in a mandatory fashion. He didn't say, I have to do this, and then did it. He said, they're advisory, and I've considered them. Isn't that what happened?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. I think that if he had viewed the sentencing guidelines as truly being advisory, he would have imposed a sentence that he had already declared to be the appropriate sentence. It was just the fact that he... changed his mind when he found out that the sentencing guidelines called for a different sentence, that he changed his mind.
But that doesn't mean he thought they were mandatory. That you agree with something, you hear something and agree with it, doesn't make it mandatory. That's a non sequitur, counsel.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think the district court judge agreed that, in light of the acquitted conduct, that the appropriate sentence was 145 months. It appeared that he believed that 84 months was the appropriate sentence. It was only once he learned what the sentencing guidelines called for that he changed his mind. So,
do you think argument in this court sometimes changes our minds?
I hope it does in this case, Your Honor, but
Do you think that means we think the argument is mandatory? Just because we find it sometimes to change our mind, does that mean we think it's mandatory?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
I noticed an argument, but it's only, so far as I can tell, it's only in your reply brief, and it's only in one line, and you haven't mentioned it. And the argument, as I understand it in this one line, it's on page 10 of your reply brief, is that the district judge was required to, but did not, make a factual finding that more than 1,000 grams of heroin were involved, that he was responsible for, that it was related conduct. And instead, all the district judges did was say, well, that was what the jury had decided, and of course I found that there was not an overall conspiracy, and I set that conviction aside. But I took your argument to be that the judge himself has to make, even if it's acquitted conduct, has to make a factual finding that that conduct was more than 1,000 grams, and he never did it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Now, what is correct? My first question was, the only place I find that argument is in your reply brief. Did you make that argument in your main brief?
That specific argument, no, Your Honor. It's simply a question of it falls under the premise of the fact that the sentence was not reasonable in light of the acquitted conduct.
That argument was not made in your blue brief, right?
But this
the reply brief, it comes too late, and there was no objection to the district court at the district court proceedings. You weren't the trial counsel, but. Or were you?
I was not the trial counsel, Your Honor. I did handle the post-trial motions and the sentencing proceedings.
Was that point raised in the district court?
Yes, Your Honor. In the district court, we did argue that the judge there was no sufficient basis to find 1,000 grams, and that the district court had no basis to find 1,000 grams.
Because that was acquitted.
I'm sorry?
Because that was acquitted conduct.
Correct, Your Honor.
Not because the district judge wasn't independently making a finding. It would still be acquitted conduct even if he made a finding.
Right, Your Honor, but the district court judge did not make a finding, and we argue that there had to be sufficient basis for the district court judge to find 1,000 grams, and he never did so. The only point he made was that the jury had convicted him on count one, and so therefore he must assume that there were 1,000 grams.
Well, it's an interesting argument. If the jury had, if the verdict on count one was not set aside, would the district judge then have to make a separate finding of more than 1,000 grams?
Well, the conviction on count one was set aside.
No, that's not my question. Suppose it was not. Suppose that he upheld that as against your motion. Would the district judge then at sentencing have to make a separate finding that more than 1,000 grams were involved? After the jury found beyond a reasonable doubt that there were?
I think in this case, perhaps the district court would have to do that. Because,
why?
Because the jury's verdict on count one was not appropriate because
you're tampering with my hypothetical. My hypothetical is that the count one is upheld.
Oh, count one is upheld.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then I suppose the district court judge would not need to make a factual finding because the jury had properly considered the issue and reached a
right.
proper factual
right.
finding. However, in this case,
what makes you think they didn't properly consider the issue and make a finding here?
Well, if Your Honor,
the jury's verdict was not overturned because of anything that bore upon that finding.
No, but the jury's verdict was overturned in the sense that the district court determined that was an improper issue before the jury. And the jury should have never been asked to decide this issue in the first place. And because it was an improper...
Wasn't that because of the variance in the indictment?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So the quantities involved should have been distributed among or should have been attributed to the single indictment, the single conspiracy that was in the indictment, or not at all?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. But there's no question the jury found the quantity.
Well, I don't know if that's necessarily true, Your Honor. I think there was some...
How could they convict if they didn't?
Well,
it would be one thing if this had been overturned on appeal or on motion for lack of sufficient evidence, yeah. Right? But it wasn't.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
I see that my time is up. May I address one other issue?
Not unless my colleagues have further questions.
No further questions.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Time is up. We'll hear from the government.
The mic will come down. No, the microphone will come down.
Okay.
At least we'll be able to hear you, even if we can't see you.
Need a phone book to stand on. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Lauren Alicon, and I represent the government. Appellant's sentence was both procedurally and substantively reasonable. The district court properly calculated appellant's advisory guideline sentence using a base offense level based on 1,000 grams of heroin and correctly imposed a two-level role in offense adjustment. The resulting within-guideline sentence is entitled to a presumption of reasonableness and should be affirmed. If I may respond to a few points that were raised by appellant. First, there is no merit to appellant's contention that his sentence violates Booker. This is a claim in both his opening and his reply brief. After Booker, the statutory maximum for an offense is the maximum penalty set by Congress, and a district court is entitled to find facts that are relevant to the defendant's sentence up to that statutory maximum. Here, the district court determined that appellant was responsible for 1,000 grams of heroin, which affected the base offense level for the purposes of calculating the appropriate guidelines range. However, the court's determination did not raise the appellant's sentence above the statutory maximum for the offenses of conviction. Rather, it affected the point within the statutory range in which the appellant's sentence was imposed. Accordingly, there was no Booker error. Appellant contends that his offense level should be based on the 608 grams of heroin that were entered into evidence, but Sentencing Guidelines 2D1.1, Application Note 12, provides that the district court should approximate the amount of drugs at issue in the case where the amount seized does not reflect the full scale of the offense. This is precisely what happened here. Given all the observations and testimony about appellant's drugs, the court concluded that it was more likely than not that the offenses involved at least 1,000 grams of heroin. That conclusion.
How did the court conclude that?
Well, the court, I think, reviewing the record, he was very troubled about what drug quantity he could ascribe to appellant, and so he held three sentencing hearings, had two PSRs prepared. He had, I think, six or eight memoranda prepared by the parties, and at the end of it, he said, I believe that 100 grams or 1,000 grams are what's the issue here. And in doing so, he found it helpful.
Where is the best statement of what you just said?
Well, I think that, admittedly, it is unclear. I think that the best statement is probably at A38, Joint Appendix page 38.
What tab are we under?
It's the Joint Appendix to appellant's opening brief, not our record materials. And so on page 38, he says, but I think I can reasonably say that at some point the court will find that there was at least 1,000 grams. Now, was there an excess of 1,000? I don't know. And then he gave the government an opportunity in the next sentencing hearing to demonstrate over 1,000 grams, because we were asking at sentencing for a number in the range of 3,500 grams of heroin. And the district court felt uncomfortable sort of dealing with the extra 2,600 grams, but felt that 1,000 grams was an appropriate base to start. Ultimately, at the end
I'm
of the...
I'm looking at A38. What is the statement on there that 16? You're...
About three-quarters of the way down the page. He says, but I think I can reasonably say that at some point the court will find...
8,000 grams, okay.
Wasn't there a point at which the defendant invoked the 1,000 grams as in a motion?
I believe that you're referring to his initial sentencing hearing, where he asked to be sentenced based on 1,000 grams of heroin.
Right.
But that was before the conspiracy count had been set aside.
Okay.
So after the conspiracy count was set aside, he then came back and asked.
You made a brief passing reference to your material. Usually when we get these from the government, they have a contents page in the front, and they have cover pages before each of the tabs to tell you what date and what hearing you're dealing with.
I have that.
I must have a flawed copy.
Oh, well, there is a table of contents in mine. There's not before.
There is a contents, I'm sorry, but there is not the cover page that usually appears. Normally, when we have one of these tabs, you turn and you see on January 9th before Judge so-and-so, who are the attorneys are, and such. I do have the contents. I had turned it without caught it together. But we don't have the, we just have blank sets there so that you do have to turn back to consult to find out what you're looking at. And
well,
it then doesn't show who counsel are and who the judge is.
Oh, I apologize, Your Honor. It's my first record materials. I will correct it in my next one.
The statement that you quoted, though, is not a finding. The court says that, that I reasonably expect at some point to make that finding. Now, where does the court make that finding? And are we dealing with a sentence enhancement that turns on whether it's more than 1,000 or 1,000 and more? Which is it?
Well, under the sentencing guidelines, 2D1.1, if the court concludes that it's over 1,000 but under 3,000, then it puts the appellant in the base offense level.
1,001.
The line is over 1,000 rather than 1,000 and over?
I believe, yes. I believe it's 1,000 to 3,000. So if they get to 1,000, then he's in the base offense level of 32.
Is that guideline set out anywhere in either brief?
That would mean that the prior tranche is up to 999. Or is expressed as less than 1,000?
I believe it's expressed as less than 1,000.
Where is the guideline in your brief?
The drug quantity table is not reproduced in our brief. We did not reproduce 2D1.1.
Give me the citation to the guideline again, then, please.
It's sentencing guidelines 2D1.1. And it's a very long provision, and it includes a drug quantity table. And for the base offense level of 32, it says at least 1 gram, but less than 3 kilograms. Sorry, at least 1 kilogram, but less than 3 kilograms of heroin. And that is, if you're using the 2007 Judge Sentel, it's page 139.
Okay, well, that's the same as the conspiracy statute.
The conspiracy charge came with a 10-year mandatory minimum if the conspiracy was to distribute 1,000 grams or more.
At least 1,000 grams.
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I get back to the question. I can't lay my hands on it, but the judge seemed to, from what he said, instead of making a finding of fact himself, said, well, I'm just going to rely on the jury's conviction on count one?
Well,
let's suppose that that's the case, that that the record shows that all he did was just rely on the conviction on count one. Is it your position that that is sufficient?
In this case, yes. Though the count was set aside due to a prejudicial variance, that setting aside had nothing to do and cast no aspersions on the facts found by the jury as relevant to the drug quantity determination. The court set it aside due to a prejudicial variance because it found that, well, appellant was the hub of the conspiracy and Ms. Williams was one spoke and Mr. Marley was another spoke. There was no interdependence between Williams and Marley, and so therefore no rim to the conspiracy.
But the defendant's related conduct was still, at least found by the jury, at least 1,000.
Exactly, Judge Randolph. The jury found that even though perhaps, or rather, the court's...
Related conduct is less stringent than necessary to prove a conspiracy, not only because of the standard of proof is different, but it's looser than...
Yes. The sentencing guidelines under 1B1.3 say that all relevant conduct can be taken into account, and then also 2D1.1 Application Note 12 discusses how in trying to determine the drug quantity, where the drug quantity that was seized does not reflect the severity of the offense, the court should approximate. And so it's a much looser idea of how you get to the total quantity of drugs at issue for sentencing purposes.
The defendant proposed making some trip, was it to the West Coast? I've forgotten.
Yes.
To buy 1,000 grams or something like that. Is that part of the evidence that's in addition to the 608 grams?
Yes. The court and the jury could have taken that 1,000 grams and then would have been at that threshold, and that would have been sufficient. I think that the sentencing guidelines, 2D1.1, say that where there's a quantity that's agreed to be purchased or agreed to be sold, you can go with that unless there is better evidence. Now, here, the only evidence we have is that appellant went to California, procured this sweater, which he said was going to contain 1,000 grams of heroin. Then he brought it back, and he was having trouble getting the heroin out of the sweater. It was sort of encased in straws that were woven in so that he could take it on the airplane, I guess, without being detected by law enforcement. And so he had the sweater, had been trying to get the heroin out, I guess got frustrated about 2 weeks after he'd received the sweater and called up Marley and said, I'm having trouble, can you get the rest of this out? And gives him half of a sweater, which is shown to have 212 grams of heroin in it. And so I think from that, one could reasonably assume that if half of a sweater 2 weeks after appellant's been trying to get this heroin out has about a quarter of the drugs that he said he was going to get, the jury or the district court could properly conclude that there were 1,000 grams in the sweater to begin with. But beyond that, there are 608 grams that no one is fighting about here, that both appellant and the government, you know, concede are at issue in the case.
So they only needed 400 in the sweater.
And then there are 200, actually, that appellant had agreed to sell to Ross. And under 2D1.1 Application Note 12, those quantities can be counted. So that gets you to 800. And so
you don't need to infer anything about this sweater beyond what was actually found in it.
Well, no, that 212 in the sweater already counts. And so including the 608,
well, that's in the 600,
which includes the sweater, and then 200 that he agreed to sell to Ross, then we're looking at these multiple other transactions, multiple other observations, the baseball-sized package of heroin that appellant gave to Miss Williams in New York and told her to put in her purse. You know, from all of these bits of the record, all the district court or the jury needed to conclude was that there was
a harmless error argument here. That, for example, the evidence, suppose the evidence shows clearly what you're saying, and they're really, it's all basically one-sided, that it shows at least 1,000 grams. And suppose as well that, what happened here, the district judge sentences in accordance with 1,000 grams or more. But the district judge neglected to say directly, I find that there was at least 1,000 grams here. Now, is there a harmless error? Would we send that back? We know what the result's going to be if we send it back. He thought he had made the finding, just forgot. Now, what's the point of sending it back?
Well, I think that's a tricky question because that is not this case. I mean, as you raised before.
Well, it might be.
Well, it might be the case.
It may well be the case. You said, I expect to find 1,000 or more grams. Then he sentences on the basis of 1,000 more grams. That may not be a hypothetical. It may be this case.
Well, Chief Judge Santel, we think that the district court made the finding. And you're correct that appellant did not raise this in his opening brief. He did not object before the district court.
He never really had a chance to raise harmless error on that.
But assuming that question were properly before the court, I think that fairly reading the record, if the court were not confident that appellant had, or that the district court had reached the proper conclusion, it could send that back. I mean, I perhaps could argue that harmless error would apply because it's clear from the record that he meant to sentence based on 1,000 grams, that he found that fact, and that the jury verdict bolsters the validity of that fact. And so...
Oh. Are we through with questions? Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Your time's up. We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal, counsel, if you'd like to respond.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Shaughnessy.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd just like to address the issue of the factual findings of 1,000 grams. As the government has stated, it is unclear. When you look at the record and when you look at their briefs, it's really unclear where 1,000 grams comes from. There's some suggestions by some incredible witnesses as to the existence of drugs, but there's no finding of where those drugs were actually found. And at no point did the government ever actually establish where this 1,000 grams comes from. While there was, where the
came from California.
Well, there's really there's no credible evidence as to the veracity of that statement, Your Honor. There's one statement by Mr. Marley, who the court has stated repeatedly throughout the proceedings that he has baggage. He's not really a very credible witness, and there's not.
Well,
really,
he wasn't discredited in the trial.
He was not totally discredited, but the weight of his testimony was low.
Well, was there an instruction to the jury to be cautious about his testimony?
No, Your Honor.
So he testified without qualification by the court that there was a quantity which apparently was counted in the original verdict on count one.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, if you look at pages 3 to 6 of Mr. Ruche's reply brief, we set out why we believe the calculation of 1,000 grams was an error. There's no sufficient basis to support that 1,000 grams. As Your Honor has noted, nowhere in the transcripts of the proceedings does it suggest that the district court made any factual finding other than to state that, well, the jury found 1,000 grams, so I'm inclined to believe the jury and just relied on the jury's verdict. One final statement is that the government raised...
Is the pre-sentence report in the government's appendix, do you know? Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I got it. Did that set forth... I haven't looked at it. Did the pre-sentence report set forth the derivation of the 1,000 grams?
And not in detail, Your Honor. I mean, there is a statement of where they suggest it comes from, but it is not... There's not a detailed statement as to where the 1,000 grams comes from. And one final comment I'd like to make, Your Honors, is that the government has mentioned that there was a two-level increase for Mr. Ruche being an organizer. As we state in our brief, Mr. Ruche was in no way an organizer of any activity. While there is statements by the government that Mr. Ruche told Ms. Williams how to drive the car to avoid detection, that under precedent from the Supreme Court and other circuits is not control. Control, as in U.S. versus Hoke and U.S. versus Beltier, is where the organizer is actually compelling somebody to do something or controlling that you do this, you do that, and they're actually have the person committing the activity cannot function without the control of the organizer. In this case, telling somebody how to drive a car is not control as required for a two-level increase. Rather, the only conduct between Ms. Williams and Mr. Ruche or Mr. Marley.
Counsel, I believe we've let you go somewhat past your 2 minutes now, okay. Haven't we? So thank you for the presentation, and the case will be submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.